Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Talk about inheritance this morning. Breaking news out of North Korea this morning. The biggest legacy from the Cold War is bubbling. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency reports that North Korea test-fired another short-range missile off its east coast this morning. This will be the sixth such launch since the North's nuclear test on Monday. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting this morning that the U.S. may push China to ban North Korean flights through its airspace to prevent the transfer and proliferation of nuclear materials. David Sanger joins us now. He's the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts on the Challenges to American Power. He joins us from Washington. Good morning, David.
Morning, John. How are you?
So all week long, we've been looking at the varied interests in this conflict and how they diverge. The U.S. has its interests. Japan has its. South Korea has its. And China has its. Then they're distinct. Everyone seems to believe that China has the power cards to play here. What do you think the likelihood is that the U.S. will be able to get China to stop overflights by North Korean flights? And give us a sense of where the drama and debate is in the White House.
Sure. It's a little bit dicey right now about what the Chinese will do. I think that many in the Obama administration were quite pleased to see that both the Chinese and the Russians, who have usually been the two who have been most reluctant to put the blocks to the North Koreans, came out and condemned the nuclear test on Monday so quickly and so vociferously. So that's the good news. The bad news is that each of them have their own reasons not to press the North Koreans too far. You know, President Bush used to say at various moments during his presidency that, you know, he and the Chinese had come to a common understanding about the threat posed by North Korea. But in fact, they never really did, because the U.S. is worried first about the nuclear threat, and the Chinese are worried first about the possibility that North Korea would collapse. Because think what happens then. You get 20 million starving, angry, cooped up people who can only go one way, north over the Chinese border. You know, it's a long swim to Japan, and the DMZ is to their south. So the Chinese want to press the North Koreans, but not to the point of collapse.
Now, on the overflight question, is this of strategic significance, or is it more a symbolic move that signals that China could do a lot more?
The biggest thing China could do if they really wanted to get the North Koreans' attention is cut off their oil, because most of the oil that flows into North Korea comes through a Chinese pipeline. And a few years ago, when we had another North Korean temper tantrum, the Chinese suddenly declared they were doing some repair work on the pipeline.
Interesting.
And turned it off for a couple of weeks. And that certainly got the North Koreans' attention. But here's why a flight ban would be important. The North Koreans have never built a weapon system that they didn't sell. They sell missiles to Iran. They sell them to Pakistan. We've talked on past shows about that nuclear reactor that the Israelis bombed in Syria two years ago. And while no one in the Israeli or U.S. government would talk about the military action, what we revealed in the Times was it was a North Korean-designed reactor being built in Syria, and U.S. intelligence missed it. So the key here is cutting off the ability of the North Koreans to sell their greatest export, which is weapons and nuclear technology. And if you're going to do that, you have to stop ships at sea, and you have to stop the overflights.
It's interesting that in this particular case, nuclear proliferation is an economic issue for the North Koreans, as well as a kind of nationalistic sort of saber rattle, and that makes it seems to me, a little harder to deal with, since it's not so much about an explicit military threat.
That's right, John. I mean, look, no one thinks that the North Koreans are going to lob a missile, nuclear or otherwise, at the Japanese or the South Koreans or at us. They don't want to do anything that's got a return address on it, because they value survival of the regime above all other priorities, and to do that would be to invite the destruction of the regime pretty quickly. But sales are a significant issue, and their biggest threat right now is that they could, in fact, become a nuclear proliferator. that's the one threat that you heard General Jones, James Jones, the new National Security Advisor,
right,
discuss. It's the one that you heard Defense Secretary Robert Gates talk about on his flight over to the Asian Security Summit last night. So that's what everybody's focused on. It's not a military action, which is why, to some degree, you can sort of ignore these short-range missile launches as kind of background noise.
You know, you've talked on this program before about the pattern with North Korea, that this sort of escalation begins, and then North Korea ends up getting something as a result. During the Clinton administration, it was an offer to build a nuclear reactor for so-called peacetime purposes. It seems that North Korea traditionally responds to these threats on the carrot end, not on the stick end. And your article suggests that Barack Obama may be shifting to more of a stick approach, a more punitive approach. Is that possible?
He may well be. I mean, the characteristic for President Obama has been to do both. I mean, as in the case of Iran, to offer negotiations, and they certainly have offered the North Koreans that they would restart the six-party talks, but also to increase the pressure. The question is how you mix those two. But, you know, I think everybody's coming to the conclusion on North Korea that the old paradigm may be wrong. You know, there was always been a debate in Washington. Were the North Koreans just building nuclear weapons because they wanted something to sell, and that, you know, with each administration, they could re-auction the same old horse, right, and get things all over again?
Right.
I think people are coming to the conclusion that, no, the North Koreans are a weak and collapsing state. They view nuclear weapons as their only real protection against being overrun, and they are building nuclear weapons and testing them because they want to have a small nuclear arsenal as protection. Now, I believe that for some time, and so you might have to discount what I'm saying here as the possibility that, you know, I'm looking at too much evidence that the rest of the administration is sort of the new administration is coming to that conclusion. But I've heard it more and more from senior officials in the past few days who never used to say things like that.
The at least on the face of it, alarming development yesterday, North Korea declared an end to the 1953 armistice that stopped hostilities and basically set up the demilitarized zone, the DMZ that you were talking about a moment ago. What's the significance of that? And is there a contingency plan for actual troop movements in the DMZ as a result of all this?
There is a war plan with North Korea that is probably the most refined, you know, rewritten, practiced war plan in the Pentagon's collection. And they've been working on it basically since the armistice was signed in the early 1950s. So, yes, there are ways to go deal with it. But the fact of the matter is that the conventional North Korean force has never been weaker. I mean, these guys barely have the fuel to have their Air Force pilots go up and practice in their aging airplanes.
Hmm.
So, you know, the threat sounds impressive, but they are in no position to restart the Korean War. The South Koreans now have a very modern military force. The U.S. is there. The Japanese have much more military capability than they ever did in the 1950s when, of course, they were just recovering from World War II and were still formally occupied by the United States. So, you know, this is, to my mind, falls in the world of empty threats.
Right.
The only card these guys have is the nuclear one.
All right. Finally, in the minute we have before we go, it sounds like the takeaway here is this is about succession. And how do we watch for signs that either succession of the regime in Pyongyang is proceeding or that the wheels have really come off the tracks and there's some total chaos emerging?
You know, it's hard to tell because we know so little about the inner operations of the North Korean regime. There is one theory under which the North Korean army is kind of getting tired of the place being run like a family business by the Kim family. And, you know, remember, you know, Kim Il-sung was the country's founder. The current leader, Kim Jong-il, is his son. And there is some suggestion that when Kim Jong-il leaves the stage, they want someone different. There is also some suggestion that Kim Jong-il's younger son might be sort of the heir apparent.
The truth of the matter is
you're not going to see it for a while.
Right, and maybe the indicator there would be how many bootleg copies of Team America World Police the Army has there in Pyongyang.
And whether they put it on national television.
Exactly.
It's just a lot of people don't have TV.
Exactly. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times, author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power, talking about the Korean Peninsula. Thank you, David.